The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. This month's guest is Helen Dunmore, and she came to talk about her 2001 novel, The Siege. It's a historical novel centred on the siege of Leningrad, that terrible episode in the Second World War when the Germans tried to starve the Russians into submission. Dunmore views it through the eyes of one family, Anna, her small brother, their father, and the doctor with whom she falls in love. Several commenters on the Guardian website expressed surprise that they could have enjoyed reading about such a terrible experience. So John Mullen began by asking Helen whether, after all her research, there were things that were just too terrible to write about.
My feeling is that all books come out of decisions that are conscious, but much more from unconscious decisions which are made over a very long period of time before the book is ever begun. And reticence, yes, there are things that are not in the book. There are things that I researched which are not in the book. There are chapters I wrote which are not in the book. So yes, it's the result of stripping down, cutting, reshaping, stripping down again. So in that way, I would say it's very edited.
Is it possible to talk about what kind of things you left out then that you thought would, that you wrote once and then decided not to put in?
I find particularly in getting to know characters, places, I tend to write more than is ever in the novel itself. Small passages of dialogue, maybe some passages that go into the past of the characters, or small meetings which won't need to take place in the final piece. It's a continuation of getting to know the world in my head, which I would do when I'm walking around or when I'm just... I suppose writing isn't what takes place at a desk, it's what takes place over maybe years and years before a novel is written.
I suppose one obvious question to ask is how you chose and why you chose to, in a way, to stop where you do rather than to start where you do, because you take us up with a kind of pitch of intensity to the sort of, where do we end? Where I guess it's kind of January 1942, and this is a siege which I think, lasted 2.5 years or something. And you take us up to the end of the sort of first 4 months or so, and then there's a break, and then we go to the first, to May after the end of that first winter. I mean, why did you decide to choose that particular kind of chronology?
Well, we begin in the early summer of 1941, and I was quite interested in the turning of the year, really, in going through that darkest winter, the first winter. I mean, if you have the siege, is Russian people call it the 900 days, but it's 872 days, and it goes through many, many phases, that period of the blockade. And I decided that my story should take place within almost one calendar year, so that we have the period just before Operation Barbarossa begins, before the German onslaught on the Soviet Union. We have a small slice of peacetime, and then we go into the period of the attacks, and then of the encirclement and the closing of the ring, and then into that first winter, the most tragic winter, really, of the siege, and then to the period where supplies are beginning to come across the Lake Ladoga route. And therefore, we're ending in May, and we're ending with the period where people are beginning to plant their vegetable gardens. A lot of people are being evacuated. Goods are coming in more. So the siege is not as... overwhelmingly, the ring is not as overwhelmingly constrictive, but you are still seeing characters who are irrevocably injured, you know, who will still not survive because they've suffered too much, really, physically, from the effects of the siege. And of course, the shelling continues as it continued and continued and continued. But I think that year, that shape of the year going from the early summer and then going through the cold coming and then that period of midwinter, which is in that latitude, it's like the pulse of life has died right down. It's very dark, it's very cold, it's very still, and you see the whole city, the pulse of the city echoing that and going down and down and down like a metronome. There's almost just a ticking.
That's sort of like the experience of reading it. I mean, it feels as though you concentrate more and more on tinier and tinier things as you get through it. You must have to be quite, as you're dealing with these terrible events, also quite sort of chilly about how precisely you measure that sort of rhythm of the narrative.
No, I don't think that's the way I work at all. I'm probably more sensuously involved in the life of the book, perhaps. And I think technique is a very complex matter, because if you have honed your technique over a very long period, then ideally a novelist's technique should not be apparent even to themselves, and it certainly shouldn't be apparent to the reader as a display. It should be completely enfolded and it's there in order to serve a purpose. And I think my experience with writing has been that I've become less and less conscious of worrying about technique as I've felt more confident about it, in a way, even less aware of it, maybe. So, but I totally agree with you that pacing in a novel is everything, and that the slowing down and the way in which one onion or one footstep or one school book burning up in a stove becomes of overwhelming, almost a blazing significance.
Yeah.
That's, to me, how I wanted that novel to work.
I don't know, I remember the scene where she's digging up, she's heard there's some wooden blocks in a burnt down building. Mm. And I remember, and she finds a block.
And in that scene, again, I'm taking things which are very sophisticated, such as, you know, a beautifully laid parquet floor that someone's probably spent a lot of time and money and thought on, and it's probably been the pride and joy of somebody, and it's been very carefully maintained and polished. And they may have thought of a future for it. You know, they may have thought that one day perhaps it will be used by other people, or other people will dance on it or whatever. But what they would not have thought of was that in the dead of night, a young woman with a chisel would be battling to dig out these chunks of wood and take them home on a sledge. So it's this contrast between the highly wrought and then the way someone is forced to create their own small civilization in order to survive. They've got their room, they've got their child, they've got their father, they've got to create out of nothing a world that works. And it's the contrast of those two. I find that very interesting.
And these people that you invented for the novel, you mentioned the research that you had to do. And would it be the case that one of the peculiarities of carefully researched historical fiction is that the characters come after the subject matter of the novel? I mean, novelists usually say, oh, no, I always think of the characters first.
To some extent, yes, that's true. I was trying to think on the train here when it was that I first really became interested in what happened in Leningrad. I went back and I thought, yes, probably in teenage years being very interested in Russian culture and Russian literature. But I was also thinking about some middle-aged men who were my pupils. They would have been like mid-50s, probably 50s to mid-50s. This was 1973 to 75. So they were in the war, and they were Finns, and they were in the Winter War, and they were in the War of Continuation. And as you know, the Finnish Defence Forces also took part in the forward movement. There was Army Group Nord, the German Army, and there was also the Finnish Defence Forces. And in fact, the Germans wanted the Finns to do even more than they did. In fact, Ruti, who was the Finnish Prime Minister, and Mannerheim, decided not to do this, but to stop at a certain point. And I remember talking to my students, who were very keen to talk about their experiences in the war, which were intensely interesting to me. This guerrilla warfare, really, on the front with Russia. These images of them gliding through the forest in white, and using their knives, which a puku, they would use their knives as well as Molotov cocktails and all kinds of other things. And talking to these men, I suppose I'm very interested in that thing of civilian experience, of these, you know, first of all, these men sitting in the classroom and telling me about their experiences, and then a young woman, and the young man, and the child, and an older man. And it's very much warfare from the civilian viewpoint rather than warfare with a politico-militaristic overview. In that way, you don't have a narrative voice coming in and telling you, well, this. You learn and you experience it through the people.
You just have those three short chapters, don't you, with Pavlov.
With Pavlov, yes. The commissar.
Yeah, so he's in charge of kind of getting the city
supply
through it.
Yeah.
I suppose we need those chapters to give us some sense that
yes,
it's not mere anarchy.
it's not anarchy. And that's the very, very interesting thing to me about the siege, is that it was not anarchy. The organism of the city continued to function, albeit in such a reduced and battered and damaged way. And Pavlov, he takes various roles, I think. But I'm constantly aware, you know, here am I telling you. And in fact, you know, this book was published 10 years ago and it doesn't really belong to me anymore. It belongs to the interpretation of the readers. That I feel that very strongly. So when I say this, I'm only saying it, not giving any definitive. I feel that Pavlov, he says this thing about folding up a piece of paper, which to me is very important, that you can have a piece of paper that's as big as Lake Ladoga and you would not be able to fold it more than seven times. And to me, that summed up almost the impossibility of his task and how he had to fold that piece of paper. And he couldn't fold that piece of paper. He just had to, in some way, organise the unorganisable. Throughout the novel, on the whole, I'd made the decision not to bring in real people. Just as in The Betrayal, I haven't done that, because there are a lot of historical
Is that because,
problems
about right,
that.
Well, because then people would say X wasn't really like this, or...
Well, that's one possibility. And also there's the possibility that someone's living a whole, full, embodied life and you come along and make another story out of it, and that might not be welcome.
It's quite an unusual combination of characters you've chosen. I mean, chemistry, as it were, of characters. A man, his adult daughter, his ex-lover, his son, who is actually more like a son to his daughter, and then her would-be lover, who is also the father's encountered in when he's wounded in the defence of Leningrad. I mean, that chemistry, which is, that's what gets you in the novel, the chemistry of those five characters, that just arrived at it, or were there particular reasons why that grouping was the right one to sort of to represent this history?
Well, I realised when I wrote the final scene in the book, which is when Anna and Andrei and Kolya are walking along in the sun, and there's so much light that you can't really see who they are, and it shimmers. The perspective comes right out, so you see them almost as if they're strangers again. And I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it's something like they are mother and father and child out on, and then, but of course they are not. And then I realised when I was looking back on the book that there were two triangles. The structure was the two triangles. In the first triangle, it's a shifting one, because you have Anna's father, Mikhail, and you have his lover, Marina, and you have the mother, Vera, and you have Anna somewhere. And that's an unresolved, it keeps tipping one way or another. It's not a solid triangle. And there's a lot of pain, and there's a lot of confusion, and there's a lot of things that are not resolved. And then towards the end of the book, you see this other triangle with Anna and Andrei and, again, Kolya. And you think they are parents and child, but they're not. But it is a resolved, in a way, it's resolved. The novel, I suppose novels are about resolution and restitution, repair, those things. And there it is, there's a whole, that shape, although it's wavering in the light, is solid, I suppose. And I realised that's what the novel was always working towards. Yeah. But we're also looking at people who grew up before the revolution and people who grew up with and during the revolution. Because in Anna, obviously, we're seeing a child growing up, and in her parents, we're seeing a very different generation as well.
But that's also the extraordinary numbness that the winter and the cold and the hunger and the privation induce. You sort of feel that in another kind of novel or play where this wasn't their experience, they'd be having jolly good rows and conversations about these relationships, and it's almost as if they can't any longer stretch to that, or Anna certainly can't stretch to that.
No. I think you're absolutely right. She has got her focus. And she is someone who, for a number of reasons, personal and political, has chosen to live. She's in a profession which is not very socially regarded. It keeps her below the radar. She is not university educated. She has not developed her artistic talent. She has not had many opportunities in many ways. She's had this child put into her arms when she's very young, and she has seen that as her duty. And I found it very interesting to work with, to explore a character who is very strongly driven by ideas of duty and responsibility, but at the same time is really very imaginative, but just damping it down all the time, and quite ironic, and often sees the ridiculous side of the life she leads, you know, because Anna's observations are quite sharp. So she was very interesting to write about because she's a lot of layers, and what you see is not always the reality.
Mm. Well, it's also quite canny of you to make Anna a kind of artist manqué, and André a doctor, because this is the sort of terrible thing literary critics say, but it means that they are both, I don't know, very good at concentrating on little visual things, you know. So a lot of this novel is about things that you don't normally get described in novels, like the colour of people's skin, as well as just sort of minute signs of health, life, hope, despair. And you have got two characters who are sort of qualified to do that if we are inhabiting their minds a lot of the time.
Yes. André's profession, I think, is very important because he's a very good diagnostician. Again, he's quite earnest. You know, at the beginning, he's quite earnest in a way. And he's probably less flexible than Anna, but he has like her, that quality of perseverance, which leads him to be, you know, he's looking and looking and looking and persevering with looking, persevering with noticing things. And again, writing about the character later on in The Betrayal, seeing how those qualities had developed was very interesting to me. But also, he's someone who's completely thrown in to a depth of medical experience that he has to struggle with alone, without the proper medication, without proper anaesthetics, without proper anything. And in the end, he realises that he's been reduced to the, I suppose, the essential task of any healer or doctor, when everything else is gone, to be able to take a sick child from its parents' arms and give them hope that he can in some way relieve the suffering, even if it's only in a tiny way, that he's lightening that bleakness of being unattended, because there are a number of unattended deaths.
A lot of the siege is narrated in the present tense. I don't know if you've followed Philip Pullman's recent condemnation of the popularity in literary fiction of the present tense. I mean, why did it seem the natural tense for this story?
Well, it has always seemed my first novel. I wrote in the present tense, and at that time it was very unusual to do so. And it was very much remarked upon by reviewers, and I just thought it felt right to me. I think partly it enables you to cut very succinctly from scene to scene, from passage to passage, and it creates a kind of, I suppose what I believe to be true probably of fiction, is this continuous present in which everything refers to something else. And that works very well. And also it avoids the pluperfect, which I think is always worth doing.
Yeah. When you're really in the siege, there's a kind of suspension of time that, by definition, we now know the history, we now know how long it lasted. Mm. But to write a novel is to reanimate a history where people don't know how it's going to end.
Exactly. It's that forgetting the present tense in which they're living and the way that they are unaware, they don't have hindsight, they're not in any way mediating their experience through a sort of, thank goodness, you know, I know next spring this is going to happen. Yeah. I mean, as far as they're concerned, this is it, this is the eternal present moment.
There isn't a sort of vantage point beyond the end of the story where somebody's looking back and saying, wasn't that extraordinary?
No, I think that's very important, though, not to appear to, you know, as an author, not to appear to call attention to things and say, you know, oh, look, they're doing this. Yeah. This is very strange and remarkable, because that isn't, to them, not strange or remarkable at all. And it has to be very much part of the fabric, part of the texture, so that Anna won't remark the fact that she feels... her immediate response on hearing a knock on the door will be fear. And that's just natural, that's just automatic. She doesn't even think about it. And we're not asked to think about it much. But it's part of knowing who she is and what place she lives in and what her past is.
So even the deaths within the family group are kind of experienced in this curiously muted way. There isn't space or energy almost for kind of regret, mourning, sort of a proper experience of emotions.
No, or there is some postponement.
Yes.
And also the physical circumstances are so extraordinary, and yet they have become to seem ordinary. I mean, it is extraordinary to think that your father will die and he will remain in the unheated room, the other room of the apartment, and he will, because it's so cold, because you've only got one little stove, that he will become frozen. And he will not go through any of the process of death that, you know, means you have to have a quick burial. But he will be there. And therefore, people will be almost, not judged, but known by the way they respond to that. So Marina will touch him. She will go. I mean, she's almost embracing the cold, the frost, because that's what she wants now. She wants him. And even if he's dead, that's what she wants. Anna will say, you can't, you haven't got to touch, you haven't got to hold. You've got to move away into the light, to the child. Kolya will be very matter-of-fact in that odd way that a very young child can be. And Andrei will deal with it in, you know, quite a doctorly way almost. And you have the feeling that a lot of things have to be postponed. It's like a wave that cannot break because it's frozen.
The other thing you do narratively to represent what passes for normality is something which is still really unusual, which is you have some passages of narrative in the second person, you.
They're meant to show the spread of experience and the fact that there is this whole city full of so many people. You know, we're focusing on this small group, but we're also aware of and responding to and in the experience of all the other people. I was very interested in the whole idea of how a city operates or doesn't operate, because we see it at its extreme. And one of the things that struck me very much in people's accounts was silence, stillness, frozenness, sound stopping. You know, beginning with very crude things like the roads are cut, the railways are cut, just a few aeroplanes, such as the one that brings Pavlov, can come in at great risk. But what is a city? when it isn't doing those city things? That's a question that really interests me and that I've tried to explore in the novel.
It reminds me, I don't know, I expect you have once upon a time read Daniel Defoe's A Journal of the Plague Year. Have you? Because a different idea, because there's no money anymore because people don't want to touch the money. And but there's that same sense that kind of lots of people are dying, and they're all dying privately in rooms. And everybody's worried about any human contact of anybody else, which is likely to be threatening rather than helpful. And that sense of stillness is very, very much reminded me of that novel.
But what is interesting is that the fabric of the city, despite the shelling, despite the damage to water mains, despite the destruction of public transport, there was still a city.
With time that I gave other people a chance.
The Siege is a novel into which clearly quite a lot of research went, which you actually list some references. Was this the only source of information? I mean, scholarly works, were they the only source of information about what life was like?
Not really, just scholarly works, no. I think I relied quite heavily on personal accounts and voices and memoirs and journals. Because although I think, you know, scholarly writing is interesting, and in fact Sheila Fitzpatrick does introduce a large, large amount of directly quoted verbatim material, I suppose I like the first person. I like people talking about their own direct experience, even though then I would sift it and I would think about what to include and what not to include. And I think it's a very difficult set of decisions, really, because I want to remain as faithful as I can, not to travesty what I know to have been, in as far as I know it, to have been the historical reality or one of the historical realities. But at the same time, it is a work of fiction.
One of the things that struck me very much was that the spring was also the most sinister time, because that's when bodies would have started to defrost. And I was quite interested that you didn't comment on that. But then I thought, well, you've heaped it on and on and on, and it's been so depressing and so angst-ridden to read the book that occasionally I had to just put it down and walk away from it, because, you know, it really did affect me very strongly and very powerfully, and thank you for writing it. But I wondered if you had considered that as a conscious decision to leave out that the spring, which you left as a sort of a hopeful ending for the book to a certain extent, because although, you know, with the history we realised that the war hadn't ended
and that
there was a lot more of this to come. But the first spring, as you've said, was hope and children playing in the streets. But for me, when I shut the book, I thought, but what about all those bodies in the park, defrosting hideously? What about Mikhail or Mikhail? And what about children who've been left with dead parents and now they're beginning to defrost? And the smell and all the bodies that had been piled up outside the cemetery that hadn't been buried. What happened? I mean, my knowledge of history of that area era is actually just through your book, really, nothing more. So I've got so many questions I'd like to know, ask that one.
There was a big, huge, massive turnout of Leningraders in April to clear up the streets, as it was rather euphemistically known. The mass graves. Actually, it's an interesting fact that the cemetery was not the cemetery that we see now immediately. It took quite a long time for it to become the beautiful spot. Well, not beautiful, but, you know, the very tended and very iconic spot that we now visit. But this, I thought, was a very strong example of how a city's organisational power was retained through that winter, in that people did come out and do this massive, massive clearing up job, and were detailed into doing this, and because the risk of typhoid, the risk of all kinds of disease and destruction had to be avoided and was avoided. And again, the organisation of the planting So that the digging up of public land and the provision of vegetable plots for, I think, 200,000 vegetable plots, so that because the awareness was that it wasn't going to be just one year. So, again, it had required a huge social, organisational, political, human effort to restore, you know, to restore some semblance of normality to the city.
So we'll sort of, I think we probably disappear into the bowels, but we'll re-emerge, or at least Helen will re-emerge. But anyway, I'm sure you'll join me in thanking Helen very much for coming to us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.